Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and today we are going to have a fun little walk through memory lane where we will recap some of our favorite episode segments from the year 2018. We had a pretty great year. We're 30 episodes in or so, and it's mostly thanks to you guys for listening. If you're already a subscriber, thank you again for your patronage. And if you're new to this, consider subscribing. To start this best of, we're going to go back to October with our Hacked Hardware and Sad Security episode, where we covered maliciously embedded microchips in motherboards manufactured by Supermicro, as reported by Bloomberg at the time. As it turns out, there's more to this story than was originally brought to light back then, and it has been heavily refuted, but first, let's jump into the story itself.
Sounds like an oxymoron. Is it big or little? Make up your mind.
Last week, by the time you listen to this, probably 2 weeks ago, Bloomberg published an article that made resounding booms across the media webs.
Booms, huh?
Booms.
Across the media webs. By the way, every time I hear about the organization Bloomberg, I just picture that rich dude, the Monopoly guy in a top hat. It's like the perfect name for that guy.
Well, there are... Okay, yes.
Sorry. Perfect. Back to the story.
Their article was about a San Jose-based supplier called Supermicro, who you've probably never heard of, despite having probably worked with their products before, whether they be when you use cloud services or specialized hardware. They're one of the largest suppliers of motherboards for United States companies.
Server hardware.
Yep.
But they also do a lot of that rack-mounted kind of blade-type servers, mm-hmm. so not the necessarily the normal motherboard you see at home or in a desktop computer.
Yep. Well, back in 2015, is where the story starts, Amazon.com was looking to purchase an Oregon-based company called Elemental Technologies that specialized in video streaming software, and they sold this software on servers that were manufactured by Supermicro. This was back when Amazon Prime was really trying to ramp up, and so it made sense for this acquisition. Elemental had quite a few customers. Supermicro had customers in the Department of Defense, CIA. Some of their hardware was used on U.S. Navy warships. They had fingers all over the United States in very critical areas. Well, as part of this acquisition, Amazon hired a third-party company to audit Elemental's security.
Good for them.
Yeah, good. It's a smart thing to do. During the audit, though, they found a tiny microchip about the size of a grain of rice that was not a part of the board's original design.
They being the alleged third-party company.
Yep. And then Amazon reported this discovery to the U.S. authorities, who launched an investigation. And again, this is all according to the article. We'll get into it in a bit. Most of this has been heavily refuted by a lot of the companies that we're going to mention throughout it, but it's still very interesting.
I think is what you're saying, get it to it in a bit, that mm-hmm. this article, you know, to be a journalistic article, at least if you're from an ethical journalist, you go through fact checking and other things. This one, as far as evidence, 17 unnamed sources.
Yep, which is a fair amount of sources.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're following proper journalistic practices, an unnamed source doesn't necessarily mean made of information from nobody. In fact, I believe real fact-checking means other people at the journalistic organization do have to verify these mm-hmm. sources. They just protect the sources for, yep. in many cases, obvious reasons.
So around the same time of this audit and notification, Apple allegedly discovered suspicious chips from Supermicro servers in some of their systems as well. And Apple actually went around.
Technically a little before even Amazon. Yeah. This apparently happened before.
And they went through and stripped out all of their Supermicro hardware in just a matter of weeks.
Although at the time, apparently, they had an excuse for why they purchased a bunch of mm-hmm. Supermicro stuff and removed it. And this was before the story was known about this secret chip, but mm-hmm. they claimed some sort of other issue. Right?
Exactly, yeah. You know? So what did this chip do that caused all of this hoopla back in 2015? Well, supposedly the chip was able to modify the server's operating system instructions as they went from the memory location to the CPU. So it sat there in the middle and hooked into something called the baseboard management system, or baseboard management controller rather, the BMC, which basically gave it full control of the computer. The BMC is normally used for remotely managing servers. You can power down the system, check its health statistics, or in this case, modify the operating system itself.
Put stuff on the stack.
Yep. And they said the chip, it was tiny, didn't have a whole lot of power or memory, but it had two main functions. One of them was to communicate with command and control servers for further instructions, and then also to prepare the operating system to accept new code from these command and control servers. So the bottom line being that when one of these servers is turned online and connected to the internet, say in a cloud environment for Amazon, or maybe a video stream from a drone for the CIA, it would beacon out to servers controlled by whoever inserted these chips, and they could use it to backdoor the system. Pretty scary stuff. So just an update to that story. As I mentioned before, it has been heavily refuted directly after Bloomberg's reporting. And Supermicro actually released a letter on December 11th after having a very heavy third-party audit. They went through and claimed that they found no evidence of any of the microchips embedded in their systems. And they walked through their testing processes to prove to their consumers that they are more secure than Bloomberg portrays them to be. I don't think this story is done yet, and I'm sure that there is more to follow from it. For our next bit, we're going to go into one of our most heavily viewed episodes where we discuss the dark web, what it is, how it works, and what the bad guys and good guys use it for. We wanted to take this time to dive into the dark webs.
Yes, the dark webs. I think we've mentioned them in some past podcast here and there, but I think we'll talk deeper about what they really are. Yeah. And the way I kind of define them is the dark web is technically on the internet, but it's these overlay networks on the internet. These networks that use peer-to-peer based networking technology add lots of encryption and chaining on top of it to give you privacy and anonymity. And there's a bunch of different technologies to use it. We'll talk about all of them, except for maybe one. Freenet, I2P, which stands for Invisible Internet Project, Riffle, and of course the most popular, which is Tor.
Tor.
Yeah, there we go. The Onion Network.
Yes.
Sounds more like a cooking network. So yeah. And by the way, some other terminology, you know, nerds sometimes call Onion Land is what we call Tor.
Yep.
The internet to Tor nerds is the clear net, because mm-hmm. the whole point of it is to keep everything encrypted. So the internet is not necessarily that. And I think the only thing we also want to add, you might hear the term deep web out there, and a lot of people confuse deep web for dark web. So remember, this dark web, again, is this encrypted overlay network that anonymizes you. Deep web is just a term for any unindexed site on the internet. You know, we know what sites are based on Google searches and some indexing, but there's probably thousands, if not millions, of IPs and things on the internet that have a no robot, you know, type thing, and they're not indexed. That's the deep web, totally yep. different than the dark web.
So let's start with Tor, I guess, since it's the most popular. I mean, you've probably heard of Tor, I'm guessing. You've probably at least heard of the dark web. You might think that it's used mainly for criminals to do criminal activities, but Tor actually has an interesting origin story.
Yeah.
And that it was originally funded and partially developed by the U.S. Office of Naval Research and
yep.
DARPA. And it wasn't until, I think, like 10 years in, that it was handed off to basically a nonprofit that was started
EFF.
Up and now funded by the EFF.
And besides the DARPA, obviously the U.S. government started it maybe to protect their communications. But I also think, you know, we do a lot of not necessarily propaganda, but we try to get past other countries' censorship and try to democratize the world. And there's a particular channel called Radio Free Asia, which is, I guess, a democracy channel that goes to all Asia. And you can probably guess it's to get certain messages to people that might be in, say, China that have censorship. China's forever tried to jam the normal radio signal. But of course, now Radio Free Asia has internet-based radio as well. And I think one of the people from Radio Free Asia actually has, in 2014, funded over $1 million to Tor as well, and to other things like CryptoCat, all to get past the Great Firewall of China. So there's things you can do with it beyond just evil stuff. You know, it can help if you live in a place with censorship and you're trying to go to sites that are restricted, or you don't want yourself to be known by governments that control the internet and might be monitoring you.
Yeah. So let's take 15, 20 minutes or so just to go into exactly how some of this dark web technology works. Because while you may be aware of it, you might not know exactly the protocols and software that goes on behind the scenes to secure these communications. So Tor stands for the Onion Router, and it is one version of the dark web. You mentioned earlier, dark web is basically anything with like an encrypted overlay. Some definitions say that it's stuff that requires a specialized software and routing in order to access. So in this case, it is Tor, so the Onion Router, which typically comes as client software bundled with the Tor browser, which is a modified version of Firefox,
yeah,
in order to access this network.
And technically, by the way, the Tor browser, I think one of its benefits are you can get the Tor client and it, whatever browser you use will be fine, but they do a lot to harden the Tor browser. I think we'll talk a lot later about how Tor is not perfect. There are ways to attack it, and having a hardened browser is pretty important.
Exactly. So in Onion Land, as we call it, there's a few concepts that you need to understand before diving in. First, Tor is built on the concept of clients. So like my browser or my proxy with another browser pointed to it that connect into the network. Yep. And then inside the Onion network are a whole bunch of nodes. They're basically the routers that handle routing these communications in a secure, encrypted, and anonymous manner across the entire network. And typically you're connecting to servers, which are called Onion services on the network, though you can still use the Tor network to connect to ClearNet sites, yep, and still maintain some of that privacy.
Other than cookies and stuff. By the way, you could be a node. I mean, often when you install the Tor browser, this is a peer-to-peer thing. The way nodes are made is basically they use other people that use Tor as nodes to hop through. So everyone's kind of sharing each other's traffic, but also helping anonymize and encrypt it. Sometimes you can select whether or not you want to be. And later on, we'll talk about special nodes like exit nodes, which you definitely have to set up specifically in a different way.
Yep. And so part of the software bundle, the Onion Router itself is really in charge of handling all of this onion routing, as it's called, and setting up these secure communications. You want to dive into a bit how that works?
Yeah. So I guess first let's talk about how normal web traffic works. Like, say some unnamed person, not me, plays a game like Neopets or something, and I would just go into my browser, I would type Neopets, but what I may not realize is every little hop between me and my router could see that.
So now everyone knows Corey plays Neopets.
So if some dumb guy like Mark had a pineapple and was man in the middle in me, he'd start making fun of me playing Neopets. Not that that has ever happened or anything.
No.
So I don't want that. I'm going to use Tor. So really, now, if I'm using Tor, I would install it. And when I go to Neopets, what happens is that Tor client's first going to kind of query Tor for a big list of nodes, local nodes to me, different hops in that we're going to use to create an actual Tor circuit. And all these different nodes, like everything in security, we all use public-private key cryptography. Every single node has their own private key, which only they know, their own public key. And when my computer finds that first node, you know, I basically connect to it. I use my public key just to make sure we have integrity. And then we encrypt that connection using the public-private key pair. But then it goes and finds another node based on me asking it to do that. And it then encrypts that connection between it and the second node independent of me.
So now we have a link from you to the first node and a link from the first node to the second node.
And of course, me and the first node, we can see that particular traffic, but I can't see the traffic to the second node, and the second node can't see my original packet. Every node we're hopping through kind of only sees their bit of this particular traffic until it gets to something called the exit node, and that exit node is what's going to actually go to Neopets, make a connection. And by the way, the reason the exit node is important is because that exit node will see the unencrypted traffic to Neopets. It will see anything I do on Neopets.
And by unencrypted, encrypted. If you're using HTTPS, the data may still be encrypted, but the routing information, which can leak privacy details, is unencrypted.
So you don't get the Tor encryption, but if you use SSL, hopefully that will help. And by the way, I don't know if Neopets has SSL. Maybe it does now.
Really? So you don't know that in your daily visit?
Shut up. It was my daughter. I promise. No, I'm kidding. And by the way, the one thing the exit node doesn't know necessarily is the original person.
Yeah.
They don't know me or my IP. They can see what I'm, they potentially can see what I'm doing if you don't have any sort of application HTTPS encryption, but they don't know where it's coming from unless I give that up using something else.
And that's one of the great things about it is that the end of this chain doesn't know who started it. The first node doesn't know where it's all going, and every hop along the way has no idea
really,
other than
they
its
only see the little bit of routing traffic that they're responsible for.
Yeah.
So it's beautiful.
So that was just a few minutes of that episode. Be sure to check out the What is the Dark Web episode. It was one of our earlier ones where we continue to dive more in depth into exactly what the dark web is and how it works. For our next little segment, we're going to cover part of the Black Hat Security Conference that we talked about in our Las Vegas Hacking Conference Week episode. We went over a few of our favorite speakers that we saw during the Black Hat Security Conference in 2018. And for this one specifically, we're going to go into a speaker that talked about the laws around IoT security and potential litigation for IoT flaws. And we'll have a quick update after this segment as well. It was a really interesting talk.
Yeah.
He had good takeaways about just the lack of any integrity protections on these devices. They don't validate that their firmware is correct. They don't even encrypt their firmware. They don't have any of the traditional protections we would see on a normal computer like
ASLR
or other security mitigations.
Let's see if I can address space layout randomization.
Hey, there you go.
And that's like if you have a Stack Overflow, you're in memory somewhere, but you need to get to the register. So you need to know where certain things are in memory to do the jumps necessary. That ASLR is a modern mechanism that randomizes memory, making it harder, not impossible, by the way, but harder for attackers to figure out easy ways to get to where they need to be.
But so many of these devices were running operating systems from like 2002.
Linux 2.4. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty darn old.
There was one where it had a web server, where the web server had an image in it that said, best viewed in Internet Explorer 5.
Yeah, oops. And by the way, he bought these in 2017, 2018. He found an operating system that's lesser known, ECOS. It's 9 years old. It's one specifically that has no memory protection. By the way, a lot of these, they don't seem to pay attention to security because some of them rely on VPNs. But then he looked at VPN stacks and he basically said their VPN stacks make you want to cry. So lots of vulnerabilities there too.
Yeah. So I guess that's a good segue into another IoT topic that we actually went to today. A pretty good talk by a guy named IJ Polansky.
Yep, that's right. He's a lawyer, not a security expert.
Yeah, he is a lawyer. Fantastic public speaker, though. I will say that too.
Pretty funny.
He gave a talk on the liability and litigations around IoT. He's actually one of the case lawyers on a class action lawsuit against Chrysler for the GPACs.
Yeah, can people remember Charlie Miller, Chris Vlasek? We've talked about them many times. Well, there's a big class action because of that against Chrysler.
Yep, exactly. And so he actually walked through all of the potential liabilities and litigations surrounding IoT. And one of the big problems is that the laws that we have right now have not really caught up to the technology. There's not a whole lot of precedent, I guess is the correct lawyer term, when it comes to deciding if there's liability, who's in trouble, how much damages would be.
This is why he says that despite the fact that there's clearly a problem, there's no lawsuits. There's not many lawsuits. There's one he mentioned that was TrendNet, I believe.
Yep.
But for the most matter, there's not many because, you know, one, there hasn't been an IoT hack that has clearly done harm. And in legal land, to you know, do some sort of case, it has to give harm to the actual defendant. Or not the defendant, the
plaintiff.
Plaintiff. Thank you very much.
My brother's going to kill me for getting all this wrong.
Is he a lawyer?
He is a lawyer.
I did not know that. You got it right. He's going to kill me for getting it wrong. And as you said, you know, besides not causing harm, there's few accepted standards of care, few little precedent for them to go on. And really, the other issue is the people that have to take care of this, the lawyers and the actual authorities that might have to, you know, police and stuff. They just don't understand the tech
and
enough.
Especially even the judges and the jury that might be deciding on whether or not this is a someone is liable because of an attack. They're not versed in technology.
By the way, for fun, I did like one of the reasons he's a good speaker besides going into the law, he introduced a lot of fun devices, like the talk about IoT and how weird it was. He shared first a water bottle that basically if you're not smart enough to know if you're thirsty, it will glow at you once in a while to tell you to drink. A digital shower, but I'll let you share the third device.
You do it. An IoT condom.
Yes.
Where you can share your performance statistics with anyone across the world.
And see how you rate among other people.
He had a good call out that he's not sure if this is for like the most narcissistic people in the world or the most...
what'd I say?
Or the most insecure people.
That was pretty funny.
Why do we... I'm not going to touch that. No. I don't think we need that connected to the internet.
I don't think this device should exist, but I got to tell you, apparently it's... We looked it up. It's not quite out yet. Going to be a fun research project.
This will be a research project, and I hope to speak at it at DEF CON 27 next year.
Yeah. But it was a good talk. And by the way, one of our predictions was we actually think this problem is, besides more class action lawsuits coming, which is really the takeaway. He said, expect more class action lawsuits. A ton, I think, was his words. Mm-hmm. I think we'll also see some regulation. Government's going to have to start to regulate this.
Yeah. So it's definitely something to watch out for, especially this Chrysler case specifically, because I feel like it's going to potentially open the floodgates once there is now a precedent set in terms of IoT attacks.
And by the way, during that segment, we mentioned that we foresee some sort of IoT regulation coming around to add security requirements for these devices. And turns out we were correct. Towards the end of the year, California signed into law their bill number 327, which is legislation requiring certain minimum security standards for any IoT device sold in California starting in 2020. And as with most legislations, what starts in California tends to impact the rest of the country and even the world. So this is probably the first step towards actual meaningful IoT security regulations worldwide. For our final segment, we're going to walk back to a section on deep inspection. And this was actually a request from one of our viewers, just like you, that was submitted to us via Twitter. And before jumping in, I want to remind you that if you have any suggestions for future episode topics, feel free to reach out to Corey and I on Twitter. I'm at XORRO underscore. He's at SecAdept. And the both of us are at hashtag the443podcast. So with that intro, let's jump into exactly what deep inspection is.
Yeah, well, the reason we're talking about this again is deep packet inspection and my definition of it. And by the way, there's some confusion around even the term deep packet inspection. But to me, it's a new capability that firewalls, actually, WatchGuard had the capability, in my opinion, when we first started in 1996. But back then, most firewalls were just becoming stateful, and they used to be stateless. And if you think about, you know, so a firewall, to me, stateful and stateless firewalls are both firewalls that are like a mail carrier. They receive letters. They look at the envelope of the letters, and the envelope has things like IP addresses and ports, and they make decisions just on that envelope, and then they throw it on. Both stateful and stateless do that. What we're going to be talking about later is a different type of mail carrier that actually opens up the envelope, looks inside it, and makes additional decisions based on what it sees inside it.
Pretty sure that's a felony.
It probably is, but it works for this particular this particular metaphor. But anyways, back to stateful and stateless. Both those types of firewall technologies, they're just looking at packet headers. They're not really looking at the content of the packet. Other than port, they don't really care if it's HTTP, FTP, SMTP, whatever type of traffic it is. They basically just have these rules that if I get this traffic on a certain port, do I have a policy that allows that to come in or not? But one of the differences with stateful and stateless, I mean, really the difference is in their name. A firewall that is stateless, every single packet that it receives is kind of a new connection to it, and it has to base what it does with that entirely on whatever rule set is specifically written. A stateful firewall, when it sees Mark sending an envelope to me, it pays attention to some details that help it know this is an envelope I'm getting from Mark, and any other follow-up communications I'm going to do with Mark are going to be under that particular context. And the reason that's important is because of things, a lot of old school hacks and tricks you could do with packets, a lot of them having to do with a three-way handshake. So for instance, you just heard us talk about this three-way handshake. When you're allowing someone to send you traffic from the internet through your firewall, you're not just allowing that first communication, but you need to make sure the firewall allows your response back to it, allows the ACK response that comes in, or the SYN-ACK that comes back from the client again, and then allows all the different packets that are going to be coming from different source ports. Some protocols like FTP might even change port actively during it. You have to have rules for all of that stuff. And a stateless firewall, unless you write those rules, it either doesn't have them, so they're more complex to set up, or by default, its rules are only based on the SYN packet, which means that anything that's not a SYN packet that doesn't have the SYN flag is actually allowed by default. And why is that a big deal? There's a lot of tricks you can do with the stateless firewall. For instance, if I'm trying to port scan somebody, firewalls can be good or bad at hiding information about your network with port scans. Like a good firewall, if it doesn't want attackers to know whether or not you have a port open or closed, it's just not going to reply at all. It's going to drop packets. A stateless firewall, if you send maybe ACK packets at it instead of SYN packets, you get a different response from a stateless firewall that can actually tell you whether or not that port is open or closed. So there's lots of little tricks like that where if you're not paying attention to where a individual session is in that TCP handshake or in its long-term conversation, there's things that you can do to kind of evade stateless firewalls. So I hope that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I think that got it. So, and then 22 years ago or so, something else came along that's even more thorough than stateful inspection.
Yeah, I would say, so at the time, we did not have something called deep packet inspection. That wasn't a made-up marketing term, by the way. Believe it or not, like many terms, some marketer made up deep packet inspection. But what we did have at WatchGuard that was very different than stateless and stateful was something we called at the time proxies. And remember, stateless and stateful inspection, they make their decisions entirely based on just the envelope. They don't give a darn what's in the envelope.
They don't give a darn.
Yeah. If you allow web envelopes, they give no... I can't say the word. So let's say you tell a stateful even firewall to allow all web envelopes. I don't care if there's malware in that web envelope, it's going to allow it. But what a proxy did, and it did it in a technical way we might get into, but what a proxy basically did is say, I'm going to go further, and I'm going to look at what nerds call layer 7 traffic. By the way, all the stateless, stateful stuff, that's looking at layer 3 or 4. That's where all that packet header stuff is. But layer 7 is what's actually in this. Oh, this looks like HTML, so it must be web traffic. But wait a second, maybe I don't want to allow a certain type of script, or maybe I want to remove certain types of files from HTML. So proxy-based firewalls actually gave you a whole lot of more choice on what you did or didn't allow, not just for the type of traffic, but what you would accept within that traffic. And that translates to security as far as being able to strip files from content that could be dangerous. That could be something we had called protocol anomaly detection. There's a lot of nerdy RFCs, requests for comment. It's a silly name, but it actually, what they really are standards for how HTML, HD, all that stuff should work. And maybe proxies that look at layer 7 traffic can enforce those standards very strictly, which sometimes prevents security problems. So to me, this extra inspection of opening the envelope, we started it with proxies, but it was somewhere around the really early 2000s that a company called NetStream started doing it started looking at that application layer 7 traffic as well, and they called it deep packet inspection. So the difference between deep packet inspection and both stateless and stateful are simply opening up the envelope, looking at what's in it, and making extra security decisions, not just on what type of traffic it is, but what you see inside.
And these days, deep packet inspection is everywhere, and it is absolutely critical when it comes to protecting network traffic. I mean, the obvious one you already mentioned is looking up the envelope and seeing if there's a big fat virus sitting inside
of
it.
Yeah.
But even outside of that, it can help in many other ways as well. You mentioned protocol anomalies.
Yeah.
So verifying that if you have port 53 traffic, so DNS traffic coming over that connection, making sure that it is actually DNS traffic.
Yeah.
And that can help prevent things like DNS tunneling, where you can tunnel other protocols through DNS.
Or adding extra filtering capability to other ports. The reverse of that is we have something called a TCP/UDP proxy, which applies our deep packet inspection to all ports and protocols. And one of the things we can do is specifically recognize HTTP or HTML traffic. And even if you push that over a non-standard port, like for some reason you're doing port 5000 because that's your command and control HTTP botnet choice. And now if we weren't able to recognize, wait a second, this port 5000, which isn't typically web, is actually web traffic, we wouldn't be able to scan it in the way we needed to find extra badness that might be in that particular traffic.
The extra badness.
Yeah.
And it can help.
That's a technical term, by the way.
Extra badness, yes. Cyber extra badness. Make sure you get that in there.
Oh, yeah. I got to add more cybers to all my terminology. I know how security people love that.
Oh, God.
Do you guys have a drink? It's a drinking game.
Cringing so
cyber,
hard.
Cyber, cyber,
cyber. And it helps even outside of security, though. It can help with usability, too. There's some really complex protocols out there, like anything to do with VoIP. So SIP or H323, they rely a lot on the headers that are generated by the VoIP servers located internally, which often have private IP addresses. And in order to reach those servers from a external source, so someone trying to make a phone call to you, they need to know your public IP address.
Yep.
So these proxies, like RSIP or H323 proxies, can find those headers within the packet, so open up the envelope, and erase the private IPs and rewrite public IPs to help route that traffic.
Another simple example that I think every person that works at support at a firewall company learns is FTP. Mm-hmm. Now, everyone thinks FTP, port 20, very easy. But you eventually learn that there's active and passive FTP, and active is actually the most common. And when you make an active FTP connection, it actually suddenly switches over to port 20, and it does so on high ranges of ports. So if you don't have a proxy that's able to suddenly make rules to allow traffic from 1024 to 655, 3.5 or whatever it is.
Yeah, that one.
the top port. if suddenly you don't know that you are allowed to switch over to port 20 on that port range, you're not going to be able to do active FTP properly, and proxies help there.
Now, a wrench that kind of got thrown into the machine of deep inspection over the last decade or so, you're pointing at me.
Well, I wanted to, the one other thing I do want to talk about deep packet inspection, I think the wrench you're going to throw into is secure web traffic,
yes,
which we definitely need to talk about. But I do want to say there's a difference. Deep packet inspection is kind of a term that one company made up and many companies are going with. But we have always done this, I call it layer 7 or application layer inspection with proxies. And there's actually a difference in doing it as a proxy versus doing it as a streaming deep packet inspection architecture. So really, what the deep packet inspection is looking at that application data in the body of whatever the communication is. But you can actually be doing that one packet at a time and just looking at packets individually as they pass.
The Great Firewall of China is a good example of
exactly
this.
Exactly. And I call that streaming deep packet inspection. But as we just talked about, a session or a communication isn't one packet. You know, there's the three-way handshake. There's multiple communications that go back and forth. There's sometimes fragmented packets where one part of your communication for networking reasons is broken up into five fragments that go over different routes to get to you and have to be reassembled. So streaming deep packet inspection only kind of sees that application data in context of a single packet at a time, unless they do a lot of extra work to try to create some sort of additional state. And often many of them do, but to varying levels. When we say we proxy, You know, that's one way of getting deep packet inspection. But what we're literally doing is when Corey's computer sends a packet to Google's website, what happens is our proxy says, okay, I'm Google's website. You're sending a packet to me. And then our product also will say, okay, I'm also going to pretend to be the client and I will send a packet directly to Google's server. And it really kind of man and middles that connection. And it gets technical, but the main thing there is it has to reassemble every piece of that entire communication. It sees the fully reassembled session. Fragmented packets get built back together. And the long story short is this more complete way of actually, you know, building that entire application stream means it's much harder to evade our security. If you think of some of the things that products do, like IPS, being able to see a signature for a known network attack. Well, there's lots of evasions, like what if I fragment this network attack into 1,000 packets rather than one? Suddenly your signature is not going to trigger on any one of those individual packets unless you put them all back together. So I know this is kind of a diversion, but I just want to say deep packet inspection in general is great. Everyone does it, but there's actually fine differences, security differences in how you do this, whether you're doing a full reassembly proxy or whether you're doing it as a stream.
And I'm going to throw the wrench now.
Cool.
So the wrench in the machine came with the introduction of secure web traffic, as you mentioned earlier. And again, that was just a short little cut of what we had for the entire episode. Be sure to check out the What is Deep Inspection episode for a full in-depth discussion on this rather complex topic. And that wraps up our Best of 2018 episode. This was a great year, and we are looking forward to another fun year of podcasting away. Again, if you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at @XORRO_ and Corey at @SecAdept, or the both of us at the #443podcast. You can also get your daily dose of security news and insights at secplicity.org. Thanks again, and we'll see you in the new year.